KPCW News Time is 8:06. You're listening to the local news hour. This is Roger Goldman. Okay, so it felt a little chilly this morning, even though it said it was around 20. Thomas, we got Thomas Giboy from ABC4 to tell us what we can expect this weekend. Good morning, Thomas.
It is cold out there this morning, and I've seen some temperature reports throughout the Wasatch back that we do have some temperatures in the teens. So while we do have a few spots right around 20 degrees, at last check around Park City Mountain, it looks like it was kind of closer to 10 degrees. So this morning, make sure that you bundle up as you head out the door. And we'll be looking at chilly temperatures sticking around and more or less as we go through today, because the system that brought our showers yesterday, it has brought in that northerly flow of wind. So instead of feeling like an early March day, it's probably going to feel closer to an early February day, but still a nice day if you want to get out and enjoy some of the fresh snow that we picked up yesterday. Kind of picked up around half a foot between Deer Valley and Park City Mountain. And with mostly sunny skies, a nice bluebird day, just make sure that you're bundled up if you're heading up on the mountain today. With that daytime high coming in at 31 degrees in Park City, and down in Heber, we'll see a daytime high in the mid to upper 30s, right around 37 degrees. Tonight will be mostly clear and turning cold once again. It actually could be a little bit colder than what we're seeing out there this morning, with the overnight low dropping to 13 degrees in Park City. But as quickly as we get past tonight, the high pressure that's building in today is quickly going to move from west to east across our region. So instead of a northerly flow of wind like we see today, as we're going to be on the east side of the high pressure, we'll quickly be on the west side of the high pressure, resulting in a southerly flow of wind returning. The average high for this time of year in Park City is 40 degrees, and by tomorrow we'll see a seasonal daytime high of 41 under mostly sunny skies. We'll drop to 22 degrees on Saturday night under mostly clear conditions, and then for our Sunday, with that southerly flow cranking in from the southwest, we'll be looking at a daytime high likely in the mid-40s in Park City, while we could sneak into the upper 40s down in the Heber Valley. So it's shaping up to what's going to be a beautiful weekend if you want to spend some time outside after a chilly close to the work week. But with how quickly that high pressure is moving from west to east, that means as we move in from Sunday night to Monday, it moves out of the way. That's going to open up the door to another unsettled pattern that's likely going to take us through at least the first half of next week. Looks like we're going to see a system clip the northern half of the state on Monday, and then likely a stronger system between the second half of Tuesday into Wednesday. So at this point, snow looks like a pretty decent chance on Monday, 60% chance with a daytime high 40 degrees. So we will trend down a little bit, and in Park City itself should mainly be snow, but with a daytime high around 40 degrees, depending on the timing of the moisture. Don't be surprised if you could see a wintry mix. Then we clear out Monday night in the first thing on Tuesday. But as mentioned, we have another storm system Tuesday into our Wednesday, with snow likely both Tuesday and Wednesday, with daytime highs returning to the mid and upper 30s. And we could see that chance of snow lingering into our Thursday as well, with daytime highs kind of hovering near or slightly below our seasonal averages, Roger.
So, you know, it's the second week, starting the second week in March, and now people are starting to wonder, so Thomas, how long is it going to be till we get spring?
You know, that's a good question. Now, I always say through the month of March, it's just the roller coaster that we go on, because spring tries to come in and then winter still is able to fight back at this point. But typically, once we get into April and then definitely May, it's going to definitely feel like, but we'll have our glimpses over this month, but then we'll probably really start to feel like it as we move through the end of this month into April.
Okay. Thanks, Thomas. Have a good weekend.
You too.
Let's find out what these conditions mean for life in the backcountry. On the phone, I have Greg with the Utah Avalanche Center. Good morning, Greg.
Yeah, good morning, Roger. I just heard your question to Thomas about spring, and I question that. What's that all about? it's still feels like winter out there, that's for sure. And, you know, March is the snowiest month. So we have, you know, some snow you just heard in the forecast ahead for next week, early in the week, and then in the middle part of the week. And looking at the long range weather, we're not seeing a whole lot of, I'm not a meteorologist, but we're not seeing a whole lot of changes. So we're hoping for a snowy March. And the good news about that is that we're moving towards a stable snowpack. And that means that as we get storms in March, we'll be dealing with instabilities related to new snow and wind-blown snow, and not deeper instabilities that lead to those really large destructive avalanches. So I think we're set up really well for this month. We generally have a low danger on most slopes, but there is a moderate danger at the upper elevations. We can find some isolated pockets of wind-drifted snow. There were a couple reports actually along the Park City ridgeline yesterday of some shallow soft slabs of wind-drifted snow. They were about 6 inches deep, up to 40 feet wide, so not all that big. But if you get caught in one of these things in some steep terrain, even an avalanche that small is large enough to carry you through trees or something like that. So if you do get into some steep terrain, definitely pay attention to the consequences of getting caught even in a small avalanche. Then the tricky thing for today is that sunshine. I think temperatures are going to be cold enough today that we're not going to have issues with wet snow. I think you're going to see some small roller balls. I don't think we're going to have issues with wet snow, but wet snow is a notoriously tricky avalanche problem to forecast. So just pay attention to that if you are out there today and you're on some solar aspects, particularly those facing south and west, as the sun does warm the snow surface. I think it's going to be a bigger issue, if you're in some steep, confined terrain, some gully, some narrow chute where you can't escape, and even a small, loose luff of wet snow could get stuck in that and get carried and not be able to escape from it. So moderate danger up high, low danger at mid and lower elevations, and just pay attention to wet activity as the sun heats up the snow surface. And yeah, going forward, we're hopefully looking at a low danger sometime soon. And we do, all of us at the UAC, we actually like to look at the snowpack, and we think we're set up for a great March and April.
Okay, Greg, thanks very much, and have a good weekend.
You as well. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Good morning. You're listening to the Local News Hour. I'm Roger Goldman. Coming up, we'll be speaking with historian Sandra Morrison as we recognize International Women's Day by talking about some notable women in Park City history. Then Park City Councilman Ed Parisian will be by with an update of last night's City Council meeting. We're going to jam our hour at the end with Chuck Garvey of the popular jam band Mo, who they're in the middle of a fortnight appearance here at the Egyptian. Stay tuned. Park City is looking into what it would take to underground transmission lines near Bonanza Drive. KPCW's Parker Malatesta reports it's an area poised for redevelopment in the coming year.
Relocating the power lines connected to the Rocky Mountain Power substation near the Boneyard Saloon would give Park City more space to develop the Bonanza Park neighborhood. The city purchased 5 acres adjacent to the substation for an arts district in 2017. Officials are now conducting a planning study with public input to determine what sort of mixed-use development best fits. Regardless of what is chosen, Deputy City Manager Jen McGrath said relocating the power lines would help by removing the 60-foot setbacks.
What that means for us is it creates more than 40 burial plots at the cemetery, which is currently sort of maxed out. It also allows for a lot more flexibility in planning the Bonanza Park area. And it would remove the transmission lines from along Boot Hill as well.
This spring, Rocky Mountain Power will present to the Park City Council the estimated costs, potential schedule, and equipment that would be needed to underground the lines. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
So today is International Women's Day, a holiday that commemorates women's accomplishments. Here to talk about the role of women in Utah history generally and some notable women in Park City history in particular is historian Sandra Morrison. Good morning, Sandra.
Good morning, Roger.
Thanks for being here.
Oh, no problem.
Well, let's start with the unusual story of women's suffrage in Utah. When did women first get the right to vote here?
So in 1870, the Utah territorial government gave Utah women the right to vote in 1870, and then 17 years later the federal government took this right away with the passing of the Edmunds-Tucker Act, which was an anti-polygamy act. I'm not quite sure how they thought not letting women vote was going to help with polygamy in Utah, but I can't imagine what the women, especially those, you know, that were younger, that had grown up voting, you had to be 20, but you know, for 17 years they got to vote, and then suddenly it's gone.
And given the lifespan in that era, that would be for most of their adult lives.
Yeah,
they would have been able to vote. And then it's gone. Was there any explanation, is there any historical explanation as to why this got tucked into an anti-polygamy act, or
I think it was just generally the Edmunds-Tucker was just taking rights away from Utah residents, you know, left, right, and center. I mean, that was the one that made it, you know, illegal. Well, started enforcing, bigamy and polygamy and arresting, the hierarchy of the LDS Church and putting them in prison.
And so when did they get the right to vote back?
So it took nine years. Mm-hmm. No, actually, Utah gained statehood at the state constitution, they put the right for women to vote back into the Constitution, and this time it also allowed for them to run for elections as well. But of course, you know, it's the right to vote in Utah for in Utah elections. It's not federal, And that, of course, didn't happen until the 19th Amendment in 1919.
And that's a really interesting story, only because, you know, you don't think of Utah as being particularly progressive with respect to the role of women in society. So this almost seems like an unusual blip, if you will, about the attitude.
Yeah, although I think, you know, women in Utah, because you had to walk across the plains to get here, I mean, you had to be, you know...
Tough.
Yeah,
exactly.
I was going to say, you know, of a certain constitution, and you know, and a lot of times, you know, you know, life was hard. You were, you know, losing kids. Sometimes you were losing your husband, and then this whole idea of polygamy. I mean, that you didn't necessarily have the choice to become the polygamous wife, and that would, you know, create certainly resolution, you know, within you as well. It wasn't an easy life. Mm-hmm.
So speaking of not an easy life, let's talk about some of the women who sort of carved out significant roles for themselves here in Park City. When you think about women who cast a long shadow, if you will, in the history of Park City, who comes to your mind first?
Well, I think the one that comes to everybody's mind is the Utah Silver Queen. You know, what a name, Utah Silver Queen. There's only going to be one of those. Her name was Susanna Bransford Emery Holmes Dietlich and Jelichev. She actually married four times. So Bransford was her maiden name.
The Elizabeth Taylor of her era.
Yeah, well, you know, a very colorful character. You know, she made the headlines of what was the equivalent of People's Magazine of the day. So, and certainly demonstrated all the excesses of, you know, the Gilded Era of which she lived in. So, you know, she came from California and married four times and became so rich that she earned the title Utah Silver Queen.
Where did the money come from? How did she come into the? I assume it was some kind of mining operation.
Yeah, so she came to Park City in 1884 and you know, worked at one of the department stores on Main Street and met the local postmaster Albion Emery, who was also a very ambitious person. He then became CFO for the Daly Mining Company, and he was also elected to the territorial legislature from Summit County and became Speaker of the House, so very well known as well. He joined David Keith and Thomas Kearns and when they leased the Silver King mine claims, and you know, within a year they had hit high-grade silver ore and earned $94,000 in 1 year. So that gave them enough money to actually buy the claims, start investing in upgrading, sinking the shafts, and you know, because the Silver King was known for the high grade ore, it was just profits all the way. Because, you know, at that time, 1893, that was the panic, the financial panic, and that hung on the economic recession for years, and a lot of the smaller mines in Park City just closed up shop because, you know, they could get the ore out of the ground, but the amount of money it cost was equivalent to how much they were earning, so they weren't actually making a profit.
Okay, so she hits it big with him.
Yes.
Then what happens?
And then he dies.
Conveniently.
1894, he dies.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. And she actually inherits, you know, all the shares. And, you know, they reckon at the time the shares were worth $2 million in the dividends, because all the shares in the Silver King were all held by five people. That was it. So they weren't publicly traded, and so all the dividends were being paid to those five owners. And they were all, you know, extremely experienced mining men, experienced in Park City mining. So they kind of had that edge as well. They weren't foreign investors, outside investors trying to look for the next, you know, big strike. They knew what they were doing. They knew they needed to reinvest in the mine. They knew they needed to keep exploring underground so that, you know, the mine wouldn't pay out. And so the dividends, the newspapers reported, were paying a monthly income of about $12,000, which I Googled, and that's about today $400,000 a month, and there's no income tax.
Nice work if you can get it.
Get it, yes.
Okay, so we talked a little bit about her, and that was obviously an inherited, if you will, silver operation.
But I do think that she was part of the whole drive behind, you know, we've got to get involved in this. you know, I don't think that, you
she's
know,
not a passive.
No, okay, I don't that's think what she's passive at all. She, yeah, you know, I mean, that kind of decision of, okay, we're going to, you know, invest all that earnings back into the mine, that kind of thing. Yeah, I think that, you know, if it's a real marriage, then doesn't it require both people to agree?
Well, anyway, she seems like a really interesting character. Obviously, women couldn't work in the mines during this era, I assume.
Right, no, yeah. In fact, the first woman to become a miner in Park City was Shelley Christiansen, and that's not till 1976. Actually work in the mines. Women would go in the mines,
right.
But, yeah, but not work.
1976, so she probably didn't get a chance to work all that long.
No, I was going to say, because that was the era of, you know, Asako and renting the Ontario Park City Ventures. And then, you know, they couldn't make it work, and so then they leased out to Naranda, and, you know, Naranda survived until 1982, and... That.
So during this whole era, women couldn't work in the mines. What kind of businesses were women able to start, and what are some examples of some prominent women?
So, you know, obviously jobs were acceptable for some women, mostly those who were single or widowed or who had been abandoned. And so, you know, jobs around the turn of the last century would include, like, nursing. So when the Miners' Hospital opened, that opened up jobs for women. Isabel Grant was the first head nurse at the Miners' Hospital when it opened. Agnes Harrington was a bookkeeper at Welsh, Driscoll and Buck's department store on Main Street. And, you know, she was single. She never married, so that, you know, was socially acceptable. Also, Nellie Theriot, who was the daughter of Park City founders George and Rhoda Snyder, her husband died, and then she became the first woman postmaster in Park City, so after Albion Emery, right?
And that actually, being the postmaster was actually a pretty prominent position.
Yeah, in
it?
Fact, it had to be appointed by the federal government, and her luck was that, you know, Thomas Kearns had been senator from Utah for a number of years, so, you know, he could get that moved through, yeah, to get her that post.
Okay. What about entrepreneurs? Any women entrepreneurs that stand out during this era?
You know, a few different ones. One would be Carrie Vivian Hodgson, who had the jewelry store on Main Street for many years.
Was she also a single woman?
No, actually, her husband divorced her for fraternizing with other men. But, you know, she was strong enough that she actually kicked him out. He left. And she continued.
She kept the jewelry store.
And she kept the jewelry store, yeah. So,
where was it?
I think it's a cowboy boot store right now, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So many of these institutions. Okay, so she was one. Any other entrepreneurs?
And some interesting ones were diverse women. Ah Nguyen, who was called China Mary. Apparently China Mary was a term, you know, white people used for Chinese women, because that way you didn't have to actually know what their name was. They were just China Mary. And mm-hmm. So there's a number of China Marys across the U.S. She had a Chinese store in Park City for a few years, I think from 1880 to 1900, and then she moved up to Wyoming, you know, given that the Chinatown, which is here where the studio is, burned in the Great Fire of 1898. So. Everybody just lost everything, and there was a big Chinese community in Evanston, so it was probably one of the reasons she went there. And then Jane Parker, an African-American woman who was actually a wonderful baker, and mm-hmm. so, you know, did a lot of catering, and yeah.
So did she have a bakery store?
Or yeah, she apparently had a very small store as well, about where the memorial building is located.
And obviously, I understand our current mayor was the first female mayor of Park City. Any other political figures in early Park City history?
I haven't come a lot of political, you know, elected,
right.
But a lot working in government. So, you know, Park City had a library, and so the librarian was a woman. And a number of other jobs were held by women as well. Well, one of the interesting ones is the Women's Athenaeum, which got started in 1897, and that was to help educate women and offered, you know, socialization as well. But, of course, they did a lot of community service, and, you know, the city struggled with the library.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Women's Athenaeum basically ran it for them, you know, along with the one librarian. But they were the ones that were out there you know, donating the books and renovating. There was one article I read in the 1950s that so many people were leaving town that they were just dumping their books at the library. And it got to the point the library was just full of boxes and boxes of books. And they actually got one of the used booksellers, Sam Weller, to come up from Salt Lake and go through it all and figure out what was garbage and just needed to go to the dump and what they should keep. And then, you know, he basically emptied the shelves of, you know, books that nobody were reading. Mm-hmm. And then the Women's Athenaeum, you know, helped catalog everything that he recommended keeping, and then helped build the library back up to a place, well, look at it today, yeah.
And another figure whose name still sort of lingers around the city is Mother Urban. Can you tell us a little about
her? Yeah, so Mother Urban came to town in 1890, and she was a single mother. I think her husband had divorced her, and of course, you know, there's few job opportunities anyway, and even less, you know, for single women. So, yeah, she, you know, operated the houses of ill repute, you know, first on Main Street, and then the city said that, you know, she had to move off out of town, actually, in the end of the incorporated, or the city's district was Heber Ave, so she built houses on Heber Ave. After she died, Maureen Foster, who was also known as Ma Foster, she operated the boarding houses and got put out of business in a raid in 1953. And Bessie Wheeler, who was in the concrete house, which is across the street from the Kimball Garage on Heber Ave, she was also locally in operation and arrested in the Sin Raid of 1955. So Park City was...
So it's interesting. This goes on into the 50s.
Yeah, so in fact, you know, they talk about Park City's economy in the 50s because, you know, the mines have all incorporated into United Park City Mines Company at that point, who really aren't extracting any ore. You know, after the Second World War, the stockpile of metals is huge because, mm-hmm. you know, nobody knew how long the war was going to go on for, so the price had plummeted. And so there's no economy in Park City except gambling and prostitution.
Well, on that happy note, thanks for spending time with us, Sandra. We appreciate it, and we'll be right back after this. So the Park City Council held its regular meeting last night. Council member Ed Parisian is here with a debrief. Morning, Ed.
Top of the morning, Roger.
Thanks for being here. So let's see. I want to start with the UDOT presentation. I understand UDOT gave a presentation about the plans to improve the I-80 interchange at Kimball. What do you make of their decision to abandon what I thought was the most interesting plan, the one that goes underground, and where do you think we're going to go from here?
Alternative B.
I liked Alternative B.
Yeah, a lot of people did, but it got... We're going to move closer.
You got
to
get closer.
All
yes,
right.
Thank you.
It's right there. You know, it was the most expensive.
Yes.
And I think maybe that was one of the reasons they tried to maybe say, well, we can do something different.
Mm-hmm. Well, where do you think they're going to go from here?
I guess eventually they're going to build it, right? I mean, I think that they're A or C was the choices, and I think A was the one that was kind of favored at this point. The split diamond, which I never could see where the diamond was to split, so I didn't get that whole terminology. But I mean, it's in Summit County, so it's not really the Park City Council.
Right.
We don't have a vote on it. We don't really have a say. But my question was, is this going to fix it?
Right.
You know, and their answer was, yeah. So.
We'll see.
Exactly.
I know the special event staff had provided a big update yesterday. Let's talk about some of the things they did. Where do we stand in terms of the number of events expected this year, and do you think we're at the right level? There's always this tension between, you know, bringing in tourism, bringing in dollars, and the disruption that it has for the town. What's your take?
You know, I think we're at a good balance right now. It seems like we feel comfortable. We have some little time off here and there during the year, and there's the big ones, the Arts Fest and Sundance and whatnot. So, you know, we have tiers of special events, 1 through 5. So I think as a local,
right.
I feel balanced. Mm-hmm. I feel like there's some time for us there.
Okay. And there was discussion of some fee changes. Do you think the fee changes were appropriate?
Yeah. I think for the big ones, I mean, there's still the discount for the community identifying events. So that's kind of a lot of them, I shouldn't say most of them, but I think it was like about a third, 27 out of 78, what's that? Mm-hmm. My math is fuzzy in the moment, 40% is still community identifying events. And so they still get the discount.
Right.
You know.
And of course, my favorite question, will we ever see fireworks in the sky over PCMR on the 4th of July, or are we going to be droning on indefinitely?
Well, I think you can see Glenwild from here. And I mean, catch the canyons, doubt they're coming back to the park city. And we had to talk about that and about the drone shows. And, you know, my comment was like, just make sure they're fun.
As a practical matter, given sort of the ongoing issues with homeowners insurance being threatened due to wildfires, I can understand why the city would come to the conclusion of why should we create a bunch of sparks, right, given that risk?
The comment from Jenny was people like the boom. You know, it's hard to make the boom sound with drones. And so,
I don't know.
It's inevitable. It is what it is. I love fireworks. I'll go over to the canyons and catch their live fireworks and get my fill there, I guess.
And maybe that's the challenge to Jenny, is to come up with a way to make a boom without a spark.
Right. I was trying to think it over. I'm like, they should be able to do that with technology,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, you'd think they'd come up with something.
You'd think they'd figure something out.
Okay. Another big item last night, as I understand it, was the Gordo issue. And I understand you guys got a first look at the potential development of the Gordo project. Big picture, where is the Gordo project and what kind of a development was presented to you?
Well, the Gordo is the one off 248 to the north where Richardson Flat Road comes in, where that new set of lights is. Mm-hmm. So if you're leaving town, you take a right to go into Park City Heights. So you take a left, mm-hmm. and it's up in that mound back there. You don't see it necessarily.
Is it across from the film? It's this side of 40, isn't it?
It's right where the lights at the film studio.
Right.
The lights to the west, the first lights you hit.
Okay.
So maybe, half mile west?
And again, what would be, how big a parcel does the city own, and what kind of neighborhood is it that we're looking at?
There is no neighborhood there. It's all open. It kind of abuts Quinn's fields and whatnot, and it's 22 acres, so lots of room to do stuff. We got our first peek at it, so I mean, we kind of knew what was coming. They were talking park and ride, so everything that we got presented was centered around a park and ride. So they presented a village with a park and ride, or with affordable and mixed use, whatnot, and then they presented something maybe moving public works out there with a park and ride, or just maybe a flat surface lot. So I think it's up for debate what's the right thing to put in there. I'm not even sure myself.
It's an intriguing idea to move public works out there, because public works is on some really valuable land.
It really is.
And you could do something else with that area.
I would love to.
Other than having a giant pile of salt by the Starbucks, which is really what we have now, right?
Kind of, right. I mean, that's valuable salt storage. And truck storage over there. So I kind of lean towards, I'd love to see, especially with the whole Bonanza rebuild going, I'd love to see more housing in there, and we'll see how that
And how long will
out.
That process take? In other words, when do you anticipate us actually seeing decisions being made? And is what would happen, would the city turn that land over to a developer once it decided what it wanted there? How would this work?
At Gordo?
At Gordo.
Well, that seems to be where they're headed. Mm-hmm. We've got that whole Deer Valley partnership thing. We got $15 million to spend, I guess, maybe. That's pushing the urgency on it. I'd like to see us do the right thing. Mm-hmm. I don't want to rush it. You know, you rush things, you don't make the best decisions sometimes. So I like to see us think about it. Eventually do it, like, pretty soon, but not tomorrow.
Okay. I know there was a presentation of transit performance statistics. Do you think the system's doing well? And do you have ideas as to where it can be improved, or was that not one that you particularly focused on?
I'm trying to think if we...
It was on the agenda, maybe it didn't happen.
Well, it didn't. It was the staff report.
Right, the staff report.
So it was a report we got. We didn't talk about it at the meeting. Yeah. But Teresa seems to be getting back to the pre-COVID numbers. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a good thing. I mean, I grew up in cities. I love transit. It's fun. It's fun to watch people. It's fun to relax and get where you're going.
And another issue I think that came up was dining decks on Main Street.
Yeah, insofar as how it affects the Kimball Arts Fest and remuneration for that. And
so I take it there are going to be dining decks again allowed this summer. And there is some conflict with the Kimball Arts Fest because it takes up some of their real estate. Was there a resolution that was proposed to sort of work that out?
Yeah, I mean, they want remuneration or compensation, whatnot. Not necessarily cash, but because they lose booths.
Right.
So there's a few booths that they can't expand with more booths due to limitation on the size of the road and whatnot. So it was only like $10,000. Wasn't a big ask.
Not a big ask.
I didn't think so. We kind of said, yeah, you got it.
Okay.
But we want to let's continue the dialogue and see how we can fix this.
So, Ed, I believe this is probably the first time you've been here on KPCW since your election in terms of talking. Welcome.
Good. I was a DJ here for years in this corner, but it was not this brand new, shiny.
It wasn't as nice as our rear building, exactly.
Same view, though.
So, Ed, let's talk about your experience. What has been surprising to you about being on the council?
Well... A lot that isn't.
Okay.
Because I've been around, right? I don't know. It's hard to put into words what's been the surprise. It's just we don't get a chance to talk much. Obviously, due to quorum rules, we can't talk before as a group during the before the meeting. So, and things come up, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh, that's where you stand on that. Mm-hmm. It's like, and oh, that's where you stand. I thought you did that. And so it's just the surprise aspect of it. You come in, and you don't really know where your fellow counselors stand on any of these positions. So all of a sudden, you're there, 10 minutes, boom, make a decision, next agenda item. I'd like to see a little more dialogue back and forth, but I'm maybe not sure that's the process right now.
And, have you been able to sort of get to know the other council people? Is there some, because it seems to me the communication works better when there's underlying opportunity to develop at least some kind of relationships.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're all good together. And I've known them, a few of them before, for a long time. And, yeah.
How about your interaction with the staff? Have you, any surprises in terms of the way the staff interacts with the council?
I mean, again, I've known them all for years, and it's different, for sure. I mean, they have their thing, and we have our thing, and it's a back and forth, and they present, and we say yes or no, and it's just, so not really surprised. I'm not sure that's the word for it, but.
Well, it's a learning process,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, it totally. It's only been 2 months, so. Right.
And what's been your favorite part of the job?
Without a doubt, speaking for the locals. Mm-hmm. Every time I get to do it, I get excited, no matter what. Even if I get outvoted on something, I know in my heart that I spoke with locals in mind. So that is the most satisfying, and it keeps me going.
This is a small town, and people have your phone number. Have you started to get interesting communications from people who are unhappy yet? That's part of the deal.
No, I haven't got the unhappy ones. I've got the ones that call, oh, by the way, Ed, this and that and this and that. But no, not the... And most of them have been from people I know. So it's not like strangers are calling me here and there. And it's just more like, ideas, suggestions. What do you think of this? And I'm like, and I love those things. I want to talk about... I love talking to the locals.
All right, Ed, anything else you want to touch on before we go?
Well, I'm going to see you again in, 3 months? Is it every 3 months we come?
That's about what the cycle is, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm excited to be here. I'm glad I'm awake. There's a barking dog that woke me up this morning, so I'm like, all right, I'm good with that.
All right. Ed Frisian, thanks for spending time with us.
You bet, Roger.
We'll be right back after this.
All right.
More than 100 people turned out to the Wasatch County public hearing Wednesday night to support conservation easements in the North Fields. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has the details.
The Wasatch County Council voted to dedicate about $3 million to help conserve some 200 acres of the agricultural North Fields. That includes two parcels along River Road known as the Christian Mitchell property and a 167-acre piece of land owned by Laren Gertsch and his family. Heber City Mayor Heidi Franco's voice filled with emotion Wednesday night as she spoke about the Gertsch property. She's the chair of the Wasatch Open Lands Board.
This is the highest, most significant contribution that WOLB has ever seen. How many of us would be willing to sacrifice literally millions of dollars in that property value in order to preserve their land? That is incredible.
One Wasatch County resident after another came forward Wednesday night to ask county leaders to protect the fields, nicknamed the crown jewel of the Heber Valley by many at the meeting. Here's Marilyn Crittenden.
I'm here to celebrate. This is the community speaking. They want you to conserve this. They want this property protected.
The Gertsch property was the more controversial of the two hearings because the Utah Department of Transportation's choice of route for a western bypass could affect the land. It's not clear how much of an obstacle an easement would be to UDOT's choice, but Heber and Wasatch leaders say they're trying to both save the North Fields and keep options open to mitigate traffic in the valley. Landowner Laren Gertsch says he just wants to preserve his family's land.
It's not about the bypass road. It's not about anything else. I guess we want to continue to be ranchers and farmers, and we can do that in this way.
But Wasatch County Council Chair Spencer Park asked whether federal funding towards the easement could be rescinded if UDOT goes through that land.
We're all for preserving the North Fields, but we don't want to. There's another item here that's been going on way longer than 20 years, a bypass that we're trying to still make sure that we don't destroy the option of having it happen.
The lawyers in the room weighed in at length about the issue of UDOT's pending announcement and concluded the county could vote to move forward. Everyone involved will continue to work on the specifics of federal funding requirements. The council voted 6-1 to allot money toward conserving the Gertsch property. Councilmember Mark Nelson said traffic mitigation is negotiable, but preserving the North Fields is not.
My feeling is we should just pass this and deal with the rest later.
Councilmember Luke Searle was the sole no vote. He said he still has unanswered questions about the bypass. The council also voted unanimously to dedicate funds to conserve the Christian Mitchell property. After the hearing, residents flocked to congratulate Gertsch. He says he's been working towards the conservation easement for 20 years.
This is a historic day because basically there's a whole bunch of other Northfield landowners that are interested in doing conservation easements. So this is really the tip of the iceberg to preserving Wasatch County in the North Fields.
Now that the county has pledged money to the easement, Utah Open Lands, county attorneys, and the landowner will work with all the funding partners, so UDOT will still be able to use eminent domain if they choose a route that goes through the property.
Wasatch High School graduates will all wear the same color gown this year, joining a growing trend across Utah schools. KPCW's Christine Weller has more.
Up until this year, Wasatch High School graduates have worn different colored gowns. Young men typically wore black, while young women wore white and previously gold. Now, all 2024 and future Wasatch graduates will wear the same color, a change many other Utah schools have adopted as well. Wasatch High School principal Justin Kelly says a committee decided the gowns will be black with gold trim to match the school's primary colors. The decision has been years in the making, and Kelly says it's based on cost.
The committee just felt like for cost-wise, for availability to students who may not have ordered their cap and gown in a timely manner, it was cost-effective that way.
He says it's also cost-effective for families with multiple graduates over the years, as they won't have to buy multiple gowns. While Kelly said the decision had nothing to do with inclusivity, Park City High School made the change in the 2018-19 school year to be more equitable to students.
We felt like it was the right thing to do so that students felt comfortable. Everybody, you know, is graduating as a unified class, and there was no separation.
That's Principal Roger R. Bobby, who added he wasn't aware of any cost difference with the gown change. Kelly said Wasatch County residents have opposing views about the decision. R. Bobby said Park City High School also faced mixed feelings.
There had been families who their daughters had graduated in a white robe for years, and they wanted to make sure that there was a picture available for them to have a picture in the white robe instead of a red robe because the red had been associated with the boys for years. But there are other students that were very happy about it. They felt like they didn't have to make those difficult choices to wear a particular color to identify with their gender.
While the decision at the time received pushback, Arbabi said most are in support now. This will also be South Summit High School's first year where all grads will walk across the stage sporting one color. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
The jam band Mo opened the first night of a four-night run at the Egyptian last night. Here to talk about the band is founding guitarist Chuck Garvey. Good morning, Chuck, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Sorry, I'm a little bit late.
Well, maybe the show went a little late last night. I don't know, but we're glad you could join us. Chuck, for those of our listeners who are not totally familiar, can you give us a little bit about the history of the band?
The band started in upstate New York in Buffalo in 89 or so, about 90. We started playing and doing covers, but we started writing songs quickly, and we got a small but loyal fan base there in Buffalo, and then we started touring around the Northeast, and it kept growing and growing. We thought it was a hobby, but it turned into a career. It's been a strange but amazing trip to keep building on that early success.
Well, the term, when I looked on your website, the term jam band is used. What does that term mean, and how would you characterize your music?
That's a good one, because when we started playing, when the band started playing, there was no jam band kind of scene. It wasn't named that way. The thing that we were doing was, in the way that the great Grateful Dead and the Allman Brothers and also things like Miles Davis, who would just have a mode or a mood that you could solo over. We kind of put these things together into our own version of that. So we used improv with our songs, which we also were really keen to make good songs that people would remember and had great lyrics as well. So it wasn't just the music, it was making real songs that could stand on their own.
You know, by my primitive math, in 1989 and 2024 is, what, some 35 years. It's extremely rare for any business to sort of function with a core group that long, much less a band. How have you guys been able to pull this off?
Who knows? It really is because we've been friends for so long, and that really helps. With a group of any friends or colleagues might be, after about 7 or 10 years, they might not be able to see eye to eye. Mm-hmm. But it's more like a family than a business, so it's in that way it's always been viable to keep going, and we like to write new songs. Right now we're actually doing the same same thing that we've been doing for years and years is touring, and then also we have this desire to write new songs, and that's the thing that really keeps things fresh, I guess.
I was going to ask you that question, but let me ask you this. How many days a year do you tour, and how do you build a stable life? You know, you guys have been doing this for 30 years. Talk to us a little bit about how you make your life work with that many days a year on the road.
Right. It used to be, you know, when we were in our 20s, it was, you know, some years it was like 300 days on the road, you know, mm-hmm. just we were not home at all. And we were living with each other in one house. So it was pretty chaotic, and you know, we were always busy and you know, just trying to get from the East Coast and then back to the West Coast, and it was really tough, actually. But and all of us have been married. I don't have kids, but it is difficult for the guys in the band who have kids. But we, since then, we've scaled back that kind of schedule, and that's really the thing that keeps everyone sane and happy. So that it helps.
And you scaled it back. About how many days a year now are you on the road?
Right now, I would think it's just a little less than 100. Mm-hmm. But you never know. Like on some years, it might be more. If we are releasing a new album or something is going on, we might try to do more. But at this point, it's probably about 100 years. It feels like that, but 100 days.
So, again, you talked about trying to keep things fresh. At some point, obviously playing the same songs over and over again for 30 years might get to be a little wearing, I guess, unless you're Billy Joel. But talk to us a little bit about how do you keep things fresh, and do you take time when you're off the road to sort of write music and possibly figure out when you can record?
One of the things that really helps the band and our fans is that we don't play the same songs every night. Every set is different, and we usually don't repeat a song for like five shows. So sometimes it takes a while for fans to see like one song that they want to see live. It might be a couple of times that they see us in their town, you know, or if they will take a little trip somewhere else to see the band play. So the thing is, like for us, like we are not locked into like this set of songs that we have to perform. It's more it's different every night, so it keeps us on our toes, and we also try to work with sets or set lists so they segue into each other. And so there are a lot of things that we can build into a set, so we can improvise and just play different songs every night. It really helps. You know, I would never want to be able, or I would never want to play the same set for like a whole year, or, you know, that would make all of us kind of crazy, I would think. But it really helps for us to just really mix it up.
And so I take it that here at the Egyptian, each of the four nights that you're going to be here, fans can expect to hear a pretty different show every night.
Yes, completely.
How was the crowd last night?
Oh, great, great. It's a small place, but it's really fun to see And it's seated, but everyone got up and danced. And it's a nice theater. And it's, as we were talking about, like every night is different. So it's a good spot to see everyone. I'm sorry. The audience will see probably most of the songs that we have been playing live in the last year or so. They'll see many of those songs. So it's a good spot to see all of those shows or as many as they can this week.
Okay, we've been speaking with Chuck Garvey of the band Mo. They are in the middle of a four-night stand here at the Egyptian. Chuck, thanks for spending time with us, and we'll be right back after this.